and rage and rush Tolrok's men. A trooper flies through the air over Sinjir's head, arms pinwheeling as he hits the log walls with a dull crunch. The knife. Sinjir's hand finds it, and he finally gets back onto his feet. Unsteadily, for his entire body feels like it's been passed through the gastrointestinal tract of a gum dart, and he dives toward Jom's cage. He uses the knife to pick the lock. Jom, for his part, watches silently, chest heaving. A moment of sympathy plucks at Sinjir's strings. The man really is missing an eye. His left. And it was removed without elegance. The socket is just a ragged pucker. A crass asterisk of ill-stitched skin. No signs of infection, at least. That's something. The lock springs. The cage pops open. Burrell grunts.
I don't feel so good.
You don't look so good either, if you take my meaning. Sinjir winks and points to one of his eyes.
Are you drunk?
Regrettably, no. It's like something clicks in Jom's head. He grabs Sinjir by the arm and pulls him forward.
Come on, Rathbelus. Let's go find Tolrok and make him eat that knife.
No, Sinjir says. We have to go, Jom. Jazz is coming. Or she should be, if everything else is going according to plan. The commando pulls him close, even as violence unfolds around them.
That man, he took my eye, Sinjir. Cut it out of my head while he was high as a wind turbine, drunk on some kind of tree sap. Then he threw my eye into a campfire. I heard it pop and sizzle. He has to pay for all his crimes. The ones against me. The ones against these Wookiees.
You're angry.
I have gone beyond the margins of angry.
Sinjir looks around. Tolrok is nowhere to be found. The deranged governor has fled the scene. Sinjir knows how this works. Jom will go and do this no matter what he says. The question now is whether or not Sinjir will join him. And that, of course, is no question at all. Debts must be paid. Tolrok awaits, Sinjir says, grimacing.
Shall we?
It's like a giant thermal detonator primed and gone pop. Beneath the halo, Jazz sees that freedom has come to Kashyyyk. Wookiees, immediately free of the inhibitor field that suppressed their minds from the chips embedded in the back of their heads, are raging. They scale the towers of Camp Sardo. They rip at tents. They swarm over AT-ST chicken walkers, tipping them over so they crash against the ground. The forest troopers flee as Wookiees claim blasters, mount turrets, and begin to overwhelm their captors. They outnumber the Imperials by 10-1. Easy. It won't be like this everywhere. Not yet. Many of the settlements are still contained by suppression fields. The Wookiees there are still imprisoned. But with their chips cooked, they will be able to push back and claim their prisons for themselves. And not every Wookiee is in a settlement. The revolt has begun. Greybok grumbles. Hatchet leans in toward Jazz, his shriveled weakway face wearing a dubious mask.
He says the planet has had its revolutions before, you know. This one will stick, she says.
She hopes.
Need better.
Palabar points. There, as she swoops the halo low over the action, firing at troopers who are mounting guns on turrets, she sees the towering shape of the AT-AT walker ahead. The top of its cockpit is cracked open, and a familiar Wookiee is flinging the driver off into the air. Chewie waves. Solo gives her a salute from below as he slides into the opening. The refugees, Karatha and the others, walk on the back of the AT-AT like conquering Doom Riders. The halo burns sky as it blasts forward. Soon the settlement of Camp Sardo is aft. Jazz weaves the ship through the Rorschach trees. Ahead, a pair of LAITs come blasting through the mist. Hatchet surprises them with a rain of red lasers. One transport's wing peels away and eclipses the second transport. Both spin down through the mist. Fog pulses with twin explosions. Ahead, the mist thins, and one of Kashyyyk's coastlines emerges. A dark sea, the white-capped tides cutting lines across the water. Beyond that, the halo's scopes show a rocky island. That's Tulruk's fortress. A massive, log-walled monstrosity built on the cusp of a long-dead volcano.
Shall we soften them up before we set her down?
Hatchet asks. She shrugs.
Why not? Light it up.
Hatchet grins and fires up the weapon system. He cackles.
It's over,
Lozen Tulruk slurs.
The hunt has ended.
The warlord sits in his throne, slumping forward. Sap is sticky around his fingers and his lips. Jom has the thorn knife in his hand, and he has the urging of a storm in him. But Sinjir stays him with a gentle gesture. Wait, he says.
Sinjir.
To the governor, Sinjir says,
You are coming with us.
Sinjir?
This is what we do, Jom. We hunt the Imperials. We capture them and take them. He's taking a ride with us.
He presses a hand against Jom's chest.
We're not killers.
How strange that sounds coming out of his mouth. Jom's one good eye closes. His chest rises and falls. The heaving breath of a man trying to contain his fury. That eye opens again.
Fine. Lozen Tulruk, you're under arrest by authority of the New Republic. It doesn't matter,
Tulruk says, bubbles fizzing at his lips. His eyes search the space around them, but they don't seem to focus.
We're all dead. You, and all the Wookiees, even me. Oh, dead.
What? Sinjir asks. Speak sense, you slobbering blob.
If I can't have this world, then nobody can. Not the New Republic, not the Wookiees, certainly not the Empire.
The ground shudders.
What was that?
Jom asks. Another boom.
Orbital bombardment,
Tulruk says with a sloppy grin. Those two words, drawn out drunkenly.
Annihilation from the stars. Or rather, from the Star Destroyers. I sent the code. Nothing is to survive.
Sinjir whispers to Jom.
We have to move, now.
But he...
Leave him! I know when a man is broken.
Jom concedes. The two of them peel away, fleeing Tulruk's chambers. The man's gabbling laugh follows them as they go. A triumvirate of Star Destroyers floats in the slate-gray sky. Gauzy shapes hanging there above Kashyyyk like executioner blades. And destruction rains from those ships as they earn their name. Death comes in shrieking flame and shrieking light. It comes from the shuddering batteries of turbo lasers. It comes from the bellies of the beasts, dropped as propulsion bombs. It is clumsy and brutal, an act of killing like spraying a hive of wasps with a flamethrower. Imprecise, yes, but over time, effective. Jazz steps out the side door of the halo and takes a moment to watch as the ships, far off for now,
fire on the planet below with their massive, world-scouring weapons. The ground shakes just slightly, even here. Soon, she knows, the ships will come this way. Centimeters from her head, a laser bolt cracks against the side of her ship. She flinches as it brings her back into the moment. They landed the halo smack dab in the center of the fortress, taking out a couple of bolt throwers and the troopers operating them as it found its landing zone. Now, as troopers rush to greet them with screaming blasters, all they can do is hold off the swarm of Tolrok's men, hoping like hell that Sinjir and Jom show. Hatchet is by her side now, and he's got Jom's heavy cannon, a Blastech DSK loaded with steel-melting dragon's fire cells. The Weequay refugee bellows and hoots, spraying the incoming troopers with green fire. A shaggy shape darts forward off to the side. It's Greybot. A blade gleams in his lone hand. She sees the scythe-like swoop of a reek blade. He howls some battle cry in the Shriwook tongue and begins slicing and dicing troopers like they're nothing but paper to be cut into dolls. Bits of armor fling and fly. A helmet tumbles to the ground, its head still in it.
Greybok is having a good time!
Hatchet yells over the din.
Just look for the others,
she answers.
Come on, where are you?
In the distance, the three Star Destroyers begin to drift apart, each likely going on a separate bombardment course. It'll take a long while to bomb this world into submission with just three of those ships. But in the meantime, the death they cause will be unparalleled. And who truly will stop them? An ill feeling leeches at her guts. Their success in liberating this planet will do them no good if the result is blowing it all to hell.
There!
Hatchet growls and lays down covering fire as Sinjir and Jom come bolting out through a wooden archway. Behind them, forest troopers storm after in close pursuit. Jazz reaches on her belt, pulls a detonator, primes it, and pitches it. The orb flies, beeping as it goes. It lands at the feet of the troopers.
Gotcha,
she thinks. It's fire and spinning bodies as the detonator goes off. The wave of concussion almost lifting Sinjir and Jom off their feet. But the two stagger and keep hurtling forward. As they reach the halo, Jazz helps them aboard.
Yeah. Hello, honey. I'm home,
Sinjir says, giving her a wink.
I found this poor orphan, and I thought we could adopt him.
Amari,
Jom says, giving her a nod.
Your eye,
she says. It's gone. Her hand moves to his cheek, fingers searching out the crude stitching.
Didn't think I could get any prettier, did you? Proved you wrong again.
He leans in, gives her a peck.
Let's get this bird flying before hell rains down on us from those Star Destroyers, eh?
Tolrok sits, laughing at nothing. He is barely aware of the shape standing before him. His eyes blurry, strained to focus. Ah, a Wookiee. He knows this one. Subject 6391A. Designation Cracktooth. She once tried to bite her way through shackles, which broke most of her teeth. She learned the hard way that escape was not an option. And since then, she's been one of the most docile beasts in all of Tolrok's fortress. He uses her for more delicate matters. Gardening, cleaning, putting up tents. She's often nearby, and she never turns her gaze to him. Cracktooth is very respectful. Very respectful. She reaches in, her hands closing around his neck.
I have ordered.
Cracktooth bares her yellow teeth. She snaps his neck like a bird bone. So ends Lozen Tolrok.
Interlude. Duropolis. Hosnian Prime.
All right, Mr. Hetkins. Lean forward and step down,
Dr. Arsad says.
Gently, gently. Left leg first,
she adds. Dade screws up his face and eases forward off the bed. He does as she says, left leg first. As for the second leg, well, that one's gone. Blown clean off back in the thicket of Endor. He and his team were doing cleanup in the weeks after the Death Star's destruction, tracking down ragtag Imperial battalions that never made it off the surface of the Sanctuary Moon. All it took was one. One scout trooper. A scout trooper with a box of thermal detonators and the willingness to use them. Then, boom. A crater in the ground vomited fresh dirt. It rained down around him as he fell, clutching the spot where the right leg below his knee once was. Then, darkness took him. Thankfully, triage saved his life, if not the leg. And now he's here, at a New Republic vet hospital on Hosnian Prime. Living the dream, he thinks.
Go on,
Arsad says. She's an older woman, with lines drawn in her skin, deep enough they're like a knife carving a name into dark wood.
Yep. Yeah,
he says, and eases forward. The prosthetic foot clicks against the ground, and awareness blooms in the soul of the metal foot. It isn't his flesh and blood. He can feel it connect with the floor. It doesn't feel the same as the other foot. This is cold and electric. He hates it. His new toes drum impatiently, even angrily on the floor, as Arsad asks him to hold still. Nearby, an FX-7 droid's dozen spindly limbs furiously tap buttons on a diagnostic machine while also measuring and examining a scrolling holographic readout beamed above. The droid whirs and beeps. She has him stand, then walk, then sit again, then stand again. Flex and stretch, move and pivot. The droid continues to work diagnostics.
Things look fine here, Dr. Arsad says.
Thanks, Doc. Guess I'm good to go. He stretches the leg out, and the crass facsimile of a half leg hangs there like a curse. It shines. Red wires braid up through its pistons and screws. I'm less than who I was before, he thinks. An idle thought that causes anger to surge inside him like an eruption of hot lava. It's hard to swallow and force a smile, but he manages.
Not just yet, Arsad says. The leg is fine, but how are you?
Like you said, leg is fine, so I'm fine. But the way she looks at him is almost like she's looking through him. Or rather, seeing through his smokescreen.
Any bad dreams?
Nope, he lies. He doesn't flinch at remembering the one from just last night. Trapped in trees falling all around him. Hopping around on one bloody leg. The last man alive on a forest moon full of Imperials.
So you're sleeping okay?
Like a purrin Nexu. Another lie.
And no mood problems?
I definitely didn't kick a potted plant to death yesterday with my one good leg. That poor little kaduki plant. All those crushed flowers. All that spilled dirt. Not that I can see.
Suicidal thoughts?
Zero. That at least is not a lie. He wants to live. He's just not particularly happy about it. The FX-7 warbles and buzzes. Arsad nods.
The droid suggests you are not being entirely truthful.
His eyes pinch shut. Droid traitor. He should have known that being hooked up to that thing gave a lot more bio and psycho feedback than he figured on. Listen, Doc, I'm fine. I'm good, okay? I got my leg. I learned to use it, no problem. As for the rest,
I knew what I was signing up for. I didn't decide to go toe-to-toe with the Empire thinking it would be like riding the grav rails at Domino Park. I knew what could happen. I'm alive, and I'll take that as a blessing, thank the Force. And yet, Arsad says, leaning in and watching him with those kind eyes,
Republic protocol demands I not let you leave without some help.
Don't need help. Leaving is help enough. Been in this hospital for 2 months now. She hits the button, and the auto blinds rise, letting light in from the hospital courtyard. Outside, Alliance vets sit on the benches or move about on hover chairs, many tended to by FX droids. Beyond that are the crystal dunes on the outskirts of the city, on which sit dome-style Hosnian homes.
There we go. Let a little light in. We all need light.
That feels like a precursor to something.
I have 2 prescriptions for you. First is that you return here every month for group therapy. Other combat veterans gather here and talk about what they've seen and what they're feeling. It helps.
He laughs, though it isn't a happy sound. Doc, I wasn't planning on sticking around. I was thinking of going back to the NR, doing another tour. Maybe something in the Outer Rim. I don't know. Now it's her turn to laugh.
Oh, Dade, no. Your time at war is done. For you, it's peacetime, if you let it be. Now, if you want to leave Hosnian Prime, we can set you up with a therapy group on other worlds. Chandrila, Corellia. The light of the Republic reaches new worlds every day now.
He bites his lip. Okay, fine. I'll talk to a bunch of scarred-up old battle idiots like me. Are we good?
As I said, there is a second thing. Wait here, please.
As if he's going to just get up and run laps. A mischievous twinkle shines in her eye as she leaves. Dade sits there for a while, tapping his new metal toes on the floor. Click, 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 click. When she returns to the room, a droid follows close behind. This droid is unlike one he's ever seen before. It's got a clunky, squarish head, but it rolls around slowly on a blue and gold ball-shaped body. Smaller than your standard astro droid, this one only sits about knee-high. It warbles and blurps at him, focusing a pair of ocular lenses on him as it juggles its own head, which sits improbably upon its body like a box balanced poorly on a child's ball. The droid tries to stay balanced as its head dips dangerously to one side. What is this? He asks.
It's a droid, Dade.
Yeah, Doc, I see that, but why is there a droid here?
This is QT-9. He is your droid.
Dade arches an eyebrow so high, he's pretty sure it hovers a few centimeters above his head. I don't recall owning a droid.
Think of it as renting one, except for free. QT-9 is a prototype therapy droid.
I don't want, whatever that is. Arsad smirks.
I could put you in for a therapy Ewok instead. Some of the native Endor creatures have agreed to travel off-world to help veterans like you recuperate, as a manner of recompense for saving their home.
Oh, yeah. I don't want one of those. They smell horrible.
Good news, then. The droid smells clean as new metal, in part because it is new. With the Empire falling, opportunity arises across the galaxy for new technologies, droids included. This one is designed to be friendly and familiar, like a pet.
The droid rocks back and forth, purring. He sighs. I have to take the droid. For real?
And come to meetings.
Doc, you're killing me.
I think you mean, Doc, you're saving my life.
you say so. She holds his hand and clasps it tight.
I do say so, Mr. Atkins. I do. Congratulations on your new foot, your new droid, and your new lease on life. The galaxy is yours to conquer.
Thanks for your help, I guess. Dr. Arsad hugs him, then leaves him alone with the droid. Dade stretches and groans as he stands fully. Again, he feels the floor up through his clearly fake foot. Nearby is the silica-form sleeve, a.k.a. skin sock, that she told him he could pull over it if he wanted to. But honestly, he'd rather just have a weird metal foot. Why pretend? He leaves it behind. QT9 makes a string of trill beeps at him. He just shakes his head and says, "Come on, you roly-poly pain in my butt. Let's go home." Whatever that is. The droid squeals with robot delight as it trails behind. Chapter 31. Dreams. Leia knows she's just dreaming. She recognizes them for the illusion that they are. But they trouble her just the same, threading in and out of her sleep. Phantasms pursue her. She dreams of Han, dead in the snow. She dreams of poor Chewie in a cage somewhere. She dreams of herself on a table, dying as her child, no, children are born. Then comes a vision of Luke, lost among the stars, searching for something and failing, never returning. She dreams of being lost in a forest, and then of being lost inside the Death Star. She and Luke and Han are fleeing stormtroopers, trying desperately to get back to the Falcon after Obi-Wan powers down the tractor beam controls, but now she knows the dead truth. He failed. He died, and the ship is still anchored there. And even if they could find their way out of the tangle of passages, they'll never escape, and... Her stomach twists, not an alarming pain, but a kick from the child inside her. She has to sit up. Her brow is slick with sweat. The bed beneath her is too. Her hand moves to her belly and feels the shape there, shifting and stirring. He's hungry. Which means she's hungry, too. But then, a shape in the doorway. It's T2LO, one of her attendant protocol droids.
"Your Highness,"
the droid says.
"I know that it's late."
"It's late, L.O."
"Yes, Your Highness. I believe I noted that. Well, you have a visitor."
"At this hour?" The droid nods.
"It is a man named Condor Kyle,"
she explains.
"He said you would want to."
The slicer. "Let him in, L.O. I'll be out in a moment." Leia takes a moment to center herself. She puts on a robe and washes her face, then heads out to meet her guest. Condor Kyle is scruffy, but in a particularly groomed way. It seems a controlled chaos. His clothing is modern. Very modern, even by Chandrillan styles. A long dark vest with exposed arms and narrow leg leather pants. He stands as she enters.
"General Leia," he says.
"That word makes you nervous, General."
"It's just, I'm not military."
"I know. I hired you, remember?" An embarrassed smile as he says,
"Yes, of course, Your Highness."
It's funny meeting like this, late at night, in secret. Reminds her of the rebel days. Except now, she's hiding from her own government.
"You have news?"
"I do."
He sets up a small tripod in the center of the table, its metal legs clicking into place. The holoprojector immediately casts an image of the Wookiee planet Kashyyyk.
"The probe droid recorded this."
Information on Kashyyyk has been incredibly hard to come by. It is a walled, protected world. The Empire has it in a chokehold. But she hoped a small probe droid could escape their sweeps. And so she hired Condor, a friend, she understands, of Nora, to build a probe designed for stealth and capable of slicing into Imperial frequencies, and further, recording something to give her a sense of what's going on there. Most of its data has been orbital and atmospheric, though it has a long-range sensor cam that can take satellite images from above. She watches the three-dimensional scene unfold. It flickers blue as three Star Destroyers move together and begin... Oh, she says, her hand flying to her face. Orbital strikes. They're going to bomb the planet into submission. But why? Condor must anticipate that question coming, because he turns off the image, then plays an audio file.
The probe intercepted this burst of calm traffic from the surface. Lozen Tolrock sent it. I don't know why he failed to encrypt it, but the droid was able to pick it up.
The man's voice appears from the projector, accompanied by a visualization of the spikes and dips of the sound waves.
The terrorists have won, Admiral Orlan. The inhibitors are down. The animals are...
His voice slurs when he says this next bit.
Escaping the zoo. Bomb it all. Burn it to a cinder. Uploading authorization code now. Begin orbital campaign.
The voice cuts out. She takes a moment to process. Han did it. He must have. If anyone could cause an overreaction like bomb the whole planet into bits, it'd be him. But now what? An orbital bombardment will be a nasty, protracted campaign. It won't stop until most of that world is dead. And that means Han and the others cannot escape. They could die there. This is it. This has to stop now. The course of action she decided upon after her meeting with Mon Mothma can no longer wait until after Liberation Day. Even though the celebration is tomorrow, every moment counts. She must not waste them. Thank you, she says. I'll have the credits transferred to your account immediately.
Nah, he says, waving it off. Let's call this one a freebie.
I owe you credits, Condor.
Slate's clean. You can pay next time.
Thank you.
Mind if I ask, what are you going to do, Your Highness?
I'm going to do what every wife must do now and again, she says. I am going to go rescue my husband.
Grand Admiral Sloan cannot sleep. Tomorrow is the first day of the peace talks. Worry threatens to eat her up from the inside, like beetles chewing the rotten middle of an old tree. She knows her role in the peace talks, and that role is not to reach any kind of accord with the conspirators of the New Republic, but rather to distract them from the attack that's coming, and then to help marshal that attack from the ground. Rax said to her, "You will be a hero. It will cement your role as Emperor, or whatever you wish to call yourself. The galaxy will see you on all the screens. The Holonet will broadcast your valor." She asked him, "But won't I be in danger?" It seems strange, after all, to put someone of her value right in the heart of battle. She reminded him that Palpatine was notoriously reclusive. Rarely did he appear unless he already controlled the environment he was entering.
"We will control the environment," Rax said. "You'll see. You won't be in meaningful danger. They won't kill you. Besides, the attack will give you plenty of opportunity to make your way clear."
This could be a trap. Or one of his tests. Even if it is, the chance to attack Chandrila, it's tantalizing. It would grant them dominance. They would show their military might to the galaxy once more, revealing the secret fleets hiding in the various nebulae.
That thought brings chills of delight. For now, though, she needs her sleep.
She tries listening to some potboiler phonoplay about a droid detective with an artificial intelligence inside his head named Adam. But the droid is not really a detective, but rather an assassin. She tries connecting with it, but her mind keeps wandering. Then she gets up and paces her chamber, pulling up a galactic star map to behold the present state of Imperial assets. That, however, only depresses her. They've lost so much, so fast. Kuat is gone. G5623 is falling, though Rax purposefully let that one loose. And she's quietly pleased to see it go. Slavery has never been part of the perfect empire that lives inside her head. It may have been necessary for a time, but now the galaxy should be made to see the empire's glory. And you can't teach them of its splendor through slavery. Slavery is not strength. It is weakness. Citizens should serve the empire because it is right to do so. Why would any choose otherwise?
All of this is just a distraction, too.
Sleep. I need to sleep. I need to be fresh and ready and aware.
Instead, she puts on one of Rax's favorite operas, the Cantata of Cora Vasura. This version that he gave her has no words, only music. At first, she finds it as distracting as everything else. Music to her is just noise. Meaningless piffle meant to lull idiots to sleep. But soon, she realizes that she, too, is lulled by it. The strings and the drums, the hisses and the thrum. Her eyelids flutter. Her mind goes blank. Perhaps I am just such an idiot. The music draws her into it, like a gentle wave carrying her away from shore out to sea. It haunts her with its ethereal beauty.
It does not give her cause to sleep, but it lets her rest her mind for a while. Maybe she should trust Rax more often. Tomorrow is a big day. She will know soon enough if that trust is deserved, or if she has been a fool.
They work together long after dark, Temin and Brenton, and Tem pretends that it's just like it used to be. Nothing different. Everything the same. But when he asks for the arc driver for the fourth time, and Brenton just stares off at an unfixed point, Temin has to admit, things are broken. In front of them on the workbench is the Valacord Tem bought. He had the bright idea to make it self-playing, so that Dad could enjoy the music without feeling pressured to play it himself. And Brenton agreed to Temin's surprise.
But all the while, his father's been disconnected from it all. Like he's only partly there.
Dad, is something wrong?
Nothing, Brenton says. The smile on his face is small and forced. I'm just tired. It's been a long day.
Oh. Okay.
Brenton stands up suddenly.
I'm going to take a walk.
Sure. Of course he is. All these walks of his. Dad leaves. And Temin follows. As Brenton winds his way through Hana City, so too does Temin. It's almost time here in the capital. The tents are set up, as are the food stalls and the generators. The celebration of Liberation Day starts in the morning with a parade, and then Sloane arrives. Peace talks go on while Liberation Day events are ongoing. Distracting people, Temin thinks. Giving them a show, while that monster Sloane tries to talk her way out of a war crimes trial. It makes him angry that they're giving her any time at all to plead her case.
Temin has a lot of anger these days. He follows his father out of the residential district, down through the gardens and the theaters, through the now quiet old Hanatown market, past the Park Hana stands down by the sea. That's where Temin loses him. He turns the corner and poof, Brenton is gone. He wishes suddenly that he hadn't told Bones to stay back at the apartment. The droid could run a scan looking for Dad's life signature. Wait. There. He sees a shape gone off the Barbican Road and down onto the pebbled beach toward the water. Temin hurries after. The wind turns and comes up over the sea. Its fingers ruffle Temin's hair. It brings with it the smell of fish. He realizes now that down there are the docks, and by the docks is the fishery. There, droids process the day's catches, hauling in scorefin and marmal fish, starlegs and pearl shells. Right now, the fishery is quiet and dark. The piers beyond extend out into the sea like long, dark shadows. At the end of one, he sees Brenton. And Brenton is not alone. But who is the other person? Just some angler, maybe. The old salts, who used to make a living bringing in the day's catch, before it was all automated, still like to sit out there before the sun is up. Brenton just ran into one, and there they stand, having a conversation, right? It makes sense. Temin gets closer, and yet he stays quiet. He tells himself that's just so he doesn't startle them, but all the same, it's hard to ignore the doubt creeping into the back of his mind like a sneaking thief looking to steal trust away one bit at a time. He ducks around the side of the fishery. In through the windows, he sees the skeletal shadows of the droids powered down for the night, standing over the conveyor lines like frozen sentinels. Now he's glad he didn't bring Bones. If Bones is bad at one thing, it's keeping quiet. Temin darts along the far side of the fishery, coming up at the edge of the docks. He ducks behind a small mountain of fish crates. Now he can see more in the moonlight. Dad is standing there with a guardsman. Chandrillan. Doesn't Temin recognize him? He realizes that indeed he does. The man was the one guarding Yuk Tashu's cell. There's that same cresting wave of blonde hair. And he can't see it from here, but he bets the man also has a chin scar and pale eyes. Stupid, Temin thinks. Dad's just talking to a guard. Maybe about tomorrow. Mom and Dad are both scheduled to be there on the dais for Liberation Day, alongside the Chancellor and Leia and most of the other returned captives. Surely it relates to the events to come. And he was worried. Dumb, dumb, dumb. Temin stands up and jogs down the pier, waving.
Dad! Hey!
The two men turn toward him. It's then he gets that bad old feeling. Something's wrong. Brenton doesn't wave. The guardsman braces with tension.
Tim, Brenton says. Temin slows his jog and then walks slowly.
Dad, I just wanted to say hi and get away from Mom.
The guardsman scowls. Deal with this, or I will.
Brenton nods.
Temin is about to ask,
deal with what?
But he never gets the chance. His father wheels on him, a blaster in his hand. Brenton pulls the trigger.
Chapter 32.
Everything shakes and rumbles. Kashyyyk is caught in the throes of tectonic spasms. Above their heads, the packed dirt ceiling gives way one stream of soil at a time. Clumps of moss fall, and the massive twisting roots around them writhe just so, like serpents stirred from a restive sleep. Jazz waits, back pressed against the tunnel wall, as Wookiees pass her in droves. They shuffle past, growling and ululating to one another. She cannot parse their tongue. Shriwook is a guttural, glottal language that, when you listen very closely, has a bewildering complexity. She may not know what they're saying, but she can hear how they sound. They sound just as she herself feels, worried, anxious, and sad. They're so close. So close. Right up against the edge of freeing a world and a species.
of doing the right thing for the right reasons. And yet, for all their efforts, it has led to this.
The Empire, if those ships above even claim to be that anymore, is now attempting to bomb this planet to oblivion. Already she knows how this will go. Many of the newly freed Wookiees are only peripherally free. Most are still trapped in settlements, which means killing them will be as easy as firing a blaster into a bucket of frogs. Here, at least, they have the excavated root systems of the Rosher tree above Camp Sardo. Together they had time, precious little but just enough, to get most of the freed Wookiees underground before one of the destroyers appeared in the sky above to hammer them into mud, blood, splinters, and fur. Jazz thinks,
I should have stuck to bounty hunting.
All this trying to do the right thing isn't her speed. Nobody should have let her have this responsibility. It overwhelms her. It feels like a crushing weight on her shoulders, pushing, pressing, grinding her down into a greasy paste.
The Wookiees are dying. Jom has lost an eye. And maybe more than that when all this is over. They've failed.
Someone jostles into her.
It's Solo.
The half-dark of the root tunnel makes it hard to see.
Solo!
She says, and she hears the frantic sound in her voice, and she fears she's about to start blathering. And, yes, indeed, it turns out she is.
We screwed this all up. This job was too big for us. We're just bugs under their feet now. You and me, we're scum. A couple of lowlifes who tried to turn away from what we are. Just a smuggler and a bounty hunter, and...
Hey, he says.
All we did was step on the dragon's tail, and now it's turning around to bite...
Hey, take it down a notch. We ain't out of this yet. You're tired, Amari, and you haven't had enough to eat. I get it. But I need you clear for this next part.
Next part?
That's right. You and me, we are a couple of lowlifes. So we're gonna act the way the galaxy made us. Like a smuggler and a bounty hunter.
I don't follow you.
He grins.
I got a plan.
It's not a real plan, is it?
Not a complete one, but yeah, it's a plan. Mostly.
So, what is this plan?
What are we good at, you and me?
She frowns.
Lying, cheating, stealing.
The last one, she hesitates to say, because it is a truth she doesn't want to admit. Finally, she lets it slip.
Killing.
Bullseye. So we lie, cheat, and steal.
And that last part? Killing?
Well, let's see if we do the first three right. And we go from there.
Then Han tells her his plan. It's not a perfect plan. It's damn sure not a complete plan. But maybe, just maybe, it'll work. Chapter 33. Across the hangar awaits a woman so tall and so blonde, they could use her as a coastal beacon here on Chandrilla. Leia hurries toward her. A gray robe pulled tight with a hood over her head, so her face is hidden.
You can take the hood off,
the woman says.
We're alone.
Leia draws back the hood. She can't help but smile.
Mivon Verlaine,
she says.
Hello, Last Princess of Alderaan. I don't go by that anymore.
Yvonne tilts her head and gives Leia a bemused look.
To me, it's who you are. You carry the torch for our world, for our home. Don't ever set it down. I know, and I do. It's actually why I'm here today.
Yvonne Verlaine has been a friend and a cohort, and occasionally a co-conspirator of Leia's since not long after the Death Star took their homeworld from them. Verlaine helped lead the charge to bring the diaspora of Alderaan refugees together. She's been vital in that effort. And as a result, Leia hasn't seen much of her in a few years, to her shame. The pilot knows Leia well enough. Yvonne plants her fists on her hips and gives a playfully distrustful look.
I see that gleam in your eyes. What gleam would that be? You're about to go rogue.
It wouldn't be the first time, but Leia plays coy.
Me? Never. Please, Leia. I hear people whisper. I don't know what Her Highness sees in that scoundrel. And I always respond, she's a lot more scoundrel than you think. Maybe even more than he is. So spit it out. What do you need from me? I need a pilot.
Yvonne smirks.
I assumed that much. I didn't think you wanted droid repair. And where would this pilot take you? To the Kashyyyk system.
That gives Yvonne pause.
That is under Imperial control. Yes, I realize. And you're free to say no. I understand you have duties here in the New Republic now. And I also understand that with Liberation Day ramping up in, well, a few hours, you may be needed. But say so now, because I need to be off Chandrilla before it all begins. I am a pilot for the New Republic, yes. But I am an Alderaanian first, and a Republic pilot second. You command me, and I will comply, Princess. I won't command you. I'm asking as a friend. And I'm saying yes as a friend and a loyal subject. But as a friend and a loyal subject, I feel the need to utter the disclaimer. This is likely to be dangerous, and it's surely foolish. And we could instead not go to Kashyyyk and stay here and watch the festivities unfold.
Leia's about to speak, but Yvonne gives her little chance.
And yet I know you, and I know you wouldn't ask me without a very good reason. So, the cruiser's in the next hangar. You ready to go? Of course you are. Let's go flying, Your Highness. Actually,
Leia says,
we're not going to take the cruiser. Do you have a ship in mind?
She grins.
I do. And we won't be alone out there. At least I hope not. Now, let's go steal the Millennium Falcon.
Interlude. Ryloth.
The garrison is a dead place. Yendor and the others come up out of the cave, spoiling for a fight, as Dardama says,
Stocked, locked, time to shock.
There's half a dozen of the Twi'lek soldiers, each armed to the teeth with blaster rifles, detonators, and Kerclaw knives. They know opposition will be fierce up here. Even this small garrison has a trio of AT-STs and a squadron of well-armed troopers. The goal isn't to wipe them out, but to do some damage. Take out a chicken walker, maybe. Knock over a few bucket heads, then retreat to the caves once more. The Imperial probe droids can't navigate the tangled spaces beneath the surface very well. And if they were lucky enough to draw the stormtroopers down into the caverns, the rebel traps would make short work of those trespassers. And yet, when they get there, the garrison is abandoned. In the distance, the wind howls through the red rock towers.
I don't understand,
Dardama says.
This is still Ryloth, yeah? We didn't come out on some other planet?
Yendor says to her and the others,
Careful. This might still be some kind of trap.
He lifts two fingers, signaling those with him to stick close and follow behind. Worry tingles in the tips of his head tails. He's a pilot, he told them, not a soldier, and certainly not any kind of general. But they said he'd been to war. They said they needed him. So, here he is. He darts along the edge of the gray-walled garrison. Two of the three walkers are ahead, and he flinches, ready for them to attack. But the wind blows a stream of dust and dirt through the walker's legs. Up on top of it, a can cell sits perched, wings twitching. The walkers, too, are abandoned. His demolition expert, Tormo, comes up, scratching at the space between his headtails.
You want me to blow these? Or, you know, because if you ask me, we take them. We use them ourselves.
Take them,
comes a rough voice. It isn't one of their own. It's one of them. An Imperial. The Twi'leks wheel on the stormtrooper standing there at the garrison gate. His helmet is off, cradled under his hand. The armor on his left arm is peeled off, too. And that arm is swollen up underneath a swaddling of fluid-stained gauze. Even from here, Yendor can see the man is sick. Sweat beating along his brow. His face red, his eyes and nose crusted with a white rime.
"Identify yourself,"
Yendor says.
"I'm LD-22.
But his voice trails off.
"Sod it. My name is Chorn."
His arm goes slack, and the helmet clatters. The sound is a surprise enough that Yendor almost fires on the man, but thankfully, training keeps him from doing so. The others are in control, too, and don't shoot.
"You don't look so good, Chorn."
"I don't feel very good."
With his head, he gamely gestures toward his wrapped arm.
"Got a scratch on the arm while out on patrol. Some of us had our armor off because it was damn hot that day. And..."
He sighs and slumps against the side of the gate.
"Got infected."
"Where are your men?"
"Gone."
He whistles like a rocket and points to the sky.
"They left."
"Why?"
"Why stay? We're done. We lost."
"You abandoned your post?"
"I didn't."
The man laughs, and then that laugh dissolves into a fit of racking coughs.
"I would have, though, but I can't go far. I'm told most of the troops are gone. We're going."
The Twi'leks all share looks. Could it be true? If it is true, that means their planet just regained its independence through an act of despair and cowardice. Not the way Yendor expected it to come, but he won't turn away such a gift, no matter how inelegant the wrapping. One thing he knows for sure, war is a very strange animal.
"What will you do to me?"
the man asks.
"Can't take me with you. What's the point? You don't want to waste resources on me. This garrison is my grave."
Yendor is about to tell the trooper that they will waste the resources, food, medical, whatever, if only to have someone to stand trial. But also because it's the compassionate thing to do. The right thing to do. But then, a blaster shot sizzles the air. And the man falls dead. Dardama lowers her rifle.
"You heard him. The garrison is his grave."
Yendor thinks to chastise her. But maybe she's right. Maybe that was the most compassionate thing to do. Or maybe they just wanted to shoot at something today. Just to feel like they earned this victory. Either way, it is what it is. The planet, it seems, is theirs. Later, back in the caves, as reports come in confirming that the garrisons are gone and that the imperial reign of Ryloth is over, the old man Teku Aile said to Yendor, as the other Twi'leks packed up their subterranean camps,
"We are a free world now, thanks to the Twi'lek resistance, thanks to Chom Sandula, and thanks to the likes of you, too."
"It seems so."
"We will need the Republic to help ensure that this never happens again, which means we will need an ambassador to represent us."
"What are you thinking, Teku?"
Teku just smiles.
"Oh, no,"
Yendor says.
"Oh, yes."
Chapter 34. Grand Admiral Rey Sloane once ran away from home. She did this because her family was not wealthy, and because her world, Ganthel, was a way station to other worlds. Richer worlds. Greener worlds. So she did, as many children wish to do, and some even accomplish. She escaped out her window while her parents slept, and made her way to the nearest ship dock in the hope of sneaking on board a freighter and traveling the galaxy.
She, also as many children do, chickened out. But before she did, young Ray Sloan made it all the way to the ship dock, hiding between two crates of Corellium scheduled for shipment off-world. It was there, she decided, that this whole running away thing was not really in her blood. And as she turned to go home, she found her escape from between the two containers blocked by a pair of thugs from a local gang, the Kataska. Spicers and slavers who wore metal masks cut into the shapes of skulls. The two men chuckled behind their skull plates and came for her. She ran the other way and found that way blocked by two more of the Kataska gang. Sloan had no way out. They grabbed her and put a bag over her head. It was then she knew she was a goner. She would not run away. Rather, she would be stolen, abducted and carried off, not to adventure or wealth, but to a life of toil and most likely horror. Thankfully, a nearby astromech saw what was happening and set himself off as an alarm. Sirens and strobing lights that summoned the nearest dock constable to chase off the Kataska. She was free, and the moment her heels hit steel, she bolted home. Her parents never found out. Later, the Empire would come to Ganthal and clear out the scum on her world. That was when she first began to regard Imperial control as a heroic, necessary presence in an otherwise chaotic galaxy. Right now, as her command shuttle descends out of light speed, she feels the same feeling she felt then, when caught between those crates. I've no way out. I'm trapped. I need to run. Ahead sits the beautiful blue-green world of Chandrilla. A world she fears suddenly will become her pretty, pretty tomb. Chandrilla is ringed by New Republic ships. Ships born of the allegiance of worlds. Mon Cala cruisers, old Alderaanian frigates, Sullustan ring ships, not to mention a trio of new battleships, Nadiri Starhawks. All these are craft representative of worlds spurned by the Empire. The people on board those ships hate her. She has no preternatural sense for it. Sloane does not possess the Force. She cannot feel the hate coming off them in waves. It is simply an estimate that they hate her. But why wouldn't they? She represents the blunt, brute fist of the Empire they despise. Their greatest desire, she imagines, would be to cut that fist off and leave it cooling on the floor at their feet. They hate her, and she does not know why their first response is not to immediately fire upon her with all their weapons. For this reason, she already has her hyperspace drive sending fresh calculations back to the Ravager. The shuttle's pilot, Ensign Damascus, says, "They are sending escorts. Stand by." Ahead, a quadrangle formation of starfighters, Y-wings, descends upon her.
"Here they come," she thinks.
Weapons hot. But they never fire. Instead, they do as the pilot suggests. They escort her down to the surface of Chandrilla for peace talks. Or at least, the illusion of them. Out the window of her apartment, Nora spies the ships streaking across the powder-blue sky above Hana City. An Imperial shuttle sits alone in the midst of four Y-wings. Sloan is on that ship. Last she saw of Admiral Sloan, Nora was chasing Sloan's shuttle in a stolen TIE fighter. The TIE's cannons thinned the shuttle's shields until she scored a vital, direct hit, and then the shuttle detonated, catching Nora in the explosion. She survived that, to her surprise. Apparently Sloan did, too. It takes a surprising amount of sheer will not to go darting out of her apartment and into the cockpit of whatever ship she can find to finish the job she began there in orbit above Akiva. Take down Sloan. And yet, she doesn't. Instead, she quakes and she shimmers
and she wills herself to look away from the window and again at herself in the floor-length mirror. Her standing there in her naval dress uniform. She didn't even know the New Republic had naval dress. This is a uniform that echoes her old pilot flight suit, but in a formal way. It's stiff and itchy. She hates how she looks in it. She tried to tell them, "I'm not even with the New Republic anymore. I renounce that." And they told her that would be a conversation for later. She received a handwritten invitation from the Chancellor herself to come on stage with Brenton and Temin. That, in order to herald the celebration of Liberation Day, with her as one of the liberators, married to one of the liberated. The Chancellor's note said at the bottom,
"Yours is a crucial narrative, Nora Wexley. One we must tell to ourselves and to the Empire. We are lucky to have you. Will you join us?"
Now, if only she actually had her son and her husband with her, maybe she could do what the Chancellor wanted. But they're nowhere to be... Behind her, the door to the room slides open. There stands Brenton. The light of the morning meets him through the window, and the doorway frames him in just such a way. For a moment, he's her Brenton again. Boyish cheeks and wise eyes. A wry twist to his face. Hands stuffed in his pockets.
"Hey,"
she says, her voice quieter than she means. "Hey," he says. Then a cloud passes in front of the sun, and a shadow moves into the room. And then he's gone. Returned is the Brenton of now. He's thinner. His eyes are set back more, and that wry twist becomes a dark line. "I'm late," he says.
And he is.
"Yes, you are. So is your son. Have you seen him?"
Brenton twitches at that.
A fog seems to fall upon him.
No. She has no time to try to shine a light through that muddle. And even if she did have the time, it might not matter. Brenton sometimes seems like he's dozens of parsecs away.
Like he's still in that prison pod.
All she can do now is lay out his clothes. A simple formal white suit given to her by the Chancellor's people. And help him get into it. He seems to brighten for a moment. "I'm sure Temin will join us."
"At the last minute, no doubt."
"He's so much older now," Brenton says as she hands him a pair of shined brown boots. As he buckles the tops, he adds, "I regret missing all of that. Him growing up. You joining the rebellion in my stead. Gods, the rebellion isn't even a thing anymore." Then he looks up at her from the bed, and his eyes are clear and bright, but lined with trouble when he says, "I love you. And I'm sorry I missed all of it.
Are we okay?" She's frozen.
Her mouth opens, but no sound comes out of her.
All this time, she's been waiting for a moment just like this one. Some tiny glimmer of who he was. Some semblance of recognition regarding what came and then passed. And now, here it is, laid out before her, as if on a serving tray. And all she can do is stare at it and gape.
Her heart feels like an animal in a net. Her vision clouds from behind tears. She quickly blinks away.
Then it all snaps into focus. They're going to be okay.
She tells him as much, stroking his cheek.
"We're going to be okay. We may not be now, but that's okay. Because we'll get there. All of us."
He offers a small smile and nods. "Okay. I believe you."
Nora stoops to kiss her husband. He's shaking just a little.
Or maybe it's her shaking. Or both of them. The kiss is soft and slow. It isn't one of the romantic, passionate kisses of their youth, stolen under one of the market tents as rain pounded the ground and everyone huddled there to stay dry. It is a wiser, stranger, altogether more hesitant kiss.
but it's all the sweeter, too.
We have to go soon,
she says, kissing him again, this time more quickly, just a peck.
I'm sure Temin will meet us there, he says, repeating himself from before.
Almost mechanically so.
Nora flinches at it, but it's probably nothing.
She clutches his hand, gives it a squeeze.
It would surprise me if he didn't.
Temin kicks out again. His feet slam against the inside of the box. The crate rattles, and the frame shakes. But the box is made of some kind of heavy compressed wood. Ugh, it's not budging.
And it doesn't help that his whole body feels like it's been worked over by a drunken, vesselist boxer. Four arms punching him like he's just some sack of Qadari rice.
That stun blast hit him hard, left him hurting. My father shot me. What does that even mean? Why would he do that?
Temin stays still, snaps his fingers idly as he tries to imagine why Brenton would do that to him. Maybe, just maybe, Dad did it because he was trying to protect his son.
He didn't kill Temin, after all.
Maybe he knows something. Maybe he did a bad thing in service of a good thing.
Or maybe it's not his father at all.
Could it be someone else? Someone masquerading as Brenton Wexley?
Temin almost hopes that's the case. It would make this easier.
Again, he growls and renews his struggle against the box. The box shakes and shifts, but it's no good. Something's wrong. Something's going on. Something is shaking.
Beneath him, a faint vibration rises.
Someone is coming.
Hey! He shouts, slamming his heel against the underside of the box's magna-sealed lid. Hey! I'm in here! Help! Help!
No more sounds. Quiet stretches out. And then, he hears a weapon warming up.
The slow thrum to power. The box shakes, and sparks rain down on him.
Temin screams, covering his eyes with his forearm, crunching up into himself as the top of the box is burned through with a bright vibroblade and flung aside.
I have discovered you,
comes the mechanized warble of Mr. Bones.
This was the longest and most protracted game of hide-and-seek, Master Temin. But again, I am the victor. Shall we play again?
Temin springs up out of the box and hugs his skeletal droid.
It is so good to see you, Bones.
It is good to see you happy.
I'm not happy. My father shot me.
That is unfortunate, Master Temin. I will scatter his atoms in return.
Not yet. First things first. We need to get to Mom.
Roger, roger. We will find Master Temin's mom.
She needs to know that something is going on, and I don't know what it is.
But Temin aims to find out. The door to the shuttle remains closed.
Sloane needs a moment.
Behind her, she has four of her own people, and that's it. She has two royal guards. Neither were Palpatine's original guards, but the menacing red cloaks and hood helmets remain the same. She has the pilot, Ensign Kars Damascus, and she has her own attaché, Adia Wright. Trusted, necessary Adia. So trusted and so necessary that Sloane almost didn't want her to come, just in case. Even now, she says to Adia,
"This could be a setup."
I don't believe that it is,
Adia answers.
Rax could be testing us.
Rax is always testing. So let's pass his test.
Sloane scowls.
He may have sent us here to fail.
What sense would that make? Then you would just tell the New Republic who he was. You could give up Imperial assets. Him putting you in their hands would be foolish if he believed this to be a danger.
She's right, of course. Sloane knows this. She's thought this out. Just the same, she fears what will happen. The tendons in her neck are pulled taut as a tow cable. Something isn't right. None of this is right. You're just afraid. You're that girl again on Ganthal, surrounded by enemies. Don't run this time, Ray. This is the time to stand and fight. They might just take us into custody soon as we step off this shuttle, she says to Adia. The girl nods. Her eyes show a glimmer of fear at that, too.
They might. But Admiral Rax believes them to be foolishly optimistic enough not to. Let us trust in his assessment just this once.
Yes. What choice do they have, anyway?
To the pilot, Sloane says, Open the door!
Lower the ramp.
And he does. The door lifts. The ramp descends in twin plumes of steam, like the breath from a rancor's nostrils. The brightness of the day reaches her eyes, and she winces against it, shielding her face as she steps off. She expects a flurry of movement. Guards coming for her, blasters up, staves crossing. But instead, she steps forward and is met by Chancellor Mon Mothma. A tall woman with a wine-stemmed neck and hair the color of copperstone. The Chancellor dips her head.
Admiral Sloane, thank you for this.
Chancellor. She'll give that woman no more than that. Behind Mothma is the rank and file. Soldiers, guards, and of course various New Republic generals and admirals. Akbar isn't here, to her surprise. Nor is the Alderaanian traitor, Leia Organa. She wonders why. Then it hits her. They aren't here, just in case this is a trap. If this shuttle were rigged to explode, then certainly... Her chest tightens.
What if it is rigged?
It would take out the Chancellor, and a wave of soldiers and officers,
and her.
It would be what Rax wanted all along. It could be...
No, that's absurd.
She had the shuttle checked. And surely they did prelim scans before they let her land, too, looking for any kind of explosive residue or unusual chemical signatures.
We have quite a day planned,
the Chancellor says, jostling Sloane out of her grim reverie.
We have a celebration ongoing.